Thank you very much for inviting me. And because Christmas is near, I have some toys, but they play a role in my argument. So imagine that these are six animals. And so there's a crocodile, that's a chimp, that's a sheep, that's a dog, that shall be human being, and that is Yoda from Star Wars. Let's assume that's an animal too that might be debatable among philosophers, but for my argument it's important that we can treat Yoda also as an animal. Now, and here's my first thesis or my first claim. These six animals, despite all their obvious differences, have something in common, and that is morally relevant. They all have in common that they are sentient beings. Sentience in the sense of having mental states, of being capable of experiential feelings, and maybe also other kinds of states, up to thoughts and desires and other intentional states. But they are at least sentient, and why is this morally relevant? Now, here's a very rough version of an argument that has often been spelled out in animal ethics, so that I will only give a shortened version, a very rough and ready version of this general argument. If you are sentient, you can be in states that matter subjectively for you. So there is something like a first-person perspective from which you can experience something as good or as bad for yourself. So, for example, be suffering from intense or enduring pain is such a kind of a state which is intrinsically bad, I guess. And why is it morally relevant? Now, the easiest way to make this claim is by analogy to the human case. And we are also animals, as evolutionary biology tells us without any doubt. When we as humans enter into something like a moral discourse in which we try to determine what we owe to each other, in terms, for example, of moral rights, then I think we will, among other things, also refer to capabilities such as the capability to feel pain. And we find it especially important that we are protected in that regard, for example, by means of moral rights or also legal rights, so that at least against our will no one shall make us suffer. And if this matters in the human case, so if being capable of feeling pain and if pain is intrinsically worse is a moral argument in the human case, why should it matter only in the case of human animals and not other animals as well? Now, what lies behind this more or less rhetorical question is the following idea: what morality demands from us. And I think it's pretty fair to state that. Morality, at least in a rather formal sense, demands to treat like cases alike. It excludes, in other words, drawing arbitrary distinctions. Now, one might say, okay, concerning pain, it would obviously be arbitrary to treat it as morally significant in the human case and as morally irrelevant in the case of other animals, given that they also similarly or equivalently are capable of feeling pain or other states that are bad from their own first-person perspective. Now, one might argue that species membership is a factor which in and by itself is morally relevant and which makes a relevant difference. And the argument against this idea that species membership per se is morally relevant is straightforward. And the argument is well known, for example, as an invalid inference from purely empirical statements to statements with a normative content. So when I say I'm a human being, I have a human DNA, this is a purely empirical statement, and it belongs to the realm of biology. And why should, without further promises, follow from that, that I am therefore morally something special? This is not to say that it might not matter that we are humans, but the argument simply demands that then we have to show that with our humanity there comes some morally relevant features, which then might be exclusively human, or at least might be something that only few other animals have. And in a few minutes I will refer roughly to some of these properties of humans, which are, I guess, indeed morally relevant. But the argument is species membership per se is morally irrelevant. So it's speciesist, to use a famous term of animal rights theory, to treat it as if the mere fact that we are human and these are other animals, so these other animals here, maybe including Yoda, are not, that this matters so that we can exclude them from the moral realm and we are the champions of the world. So I think we should not infer that way. Why is it unfair? Okay. One might, for example, say Yoda. He is, that's the reason why I chose him. Yoda is a clever creature. He is capable of moral agency. He's autonomous. He is even more clever and smart than we are. And if we now would say that because he has, unfortunately, the wrong DNA, he's not human, as we can see, and therefore he is excluded. I think no valid moral theory that is even worth being taken seriously as a moral theory would infer that Yoda has no moral status at all. Kant, for example, would surely not say this, because he would accept that Yoda is a rational being and an autonomous being, so he is capable of moral self-legislation, and therefore he counts. And my argument was that not only creatures that are as clever and smart as Yoda is, and to a certain degree as we are, but also creatures that are capable at least of adverse feelings such as pain, matter for that regard and matter by themselves. So saying that a being has a moral status means basically that this being is owed some kind of moral consideration irrespective of the consequences for other beings who themselves have a moral status. And now I come very roughly again to the term moral rights, because I am defending an animal rights approach, although it's not so important that we use a rights talk here, but I prefer to do this for a very simple reason. I think the most straightforward way of saying why it is wrong, for example, to mistreat an animal, to let an animal suffer unnecessarily, the most straightforward way to make this plausible is by saying that it is a way of wronging the animal as an individual. So we do something wrong because we are wronging something, someone. And to wrong someone means that we do not rightly address a claim, a valid claim that this individual has against us, and from which some of our duties follow. So saying that someone has a moral right, in my rather, I think, basic sense, means something like, you are a source of valid claims. You count morally in the sense that you can expect from others something that they do or that they omit to do. And if they fail, if they do not fulfill their duty, they are wronging you in particular. I think that is the basic idea, and I think it's not metaphysically mysterious or whatever one might say against the idea of moral rights. And I think in that sense, it's also intelligible and indeed morally attractive to say that animals can also have rights in that sense, given that they have some interests that in the human case are clearly seen as morally relevant. So in some regards, they are like us, and therefore it would be arbitrary not to include them in the community of moral rights holders. So that at least is the claim. And we can combine this with another famous argument which has been brought forward in a more utilitarian framework, most famously or notoriously, as you want, by Peter Singer, and it's the argument for an equal consideration of interests. So the argument is, if an interest such as avoiding enduring and or intense pain, so if such an interest matters morally, it matters no matter whose interest in particular it is. And this includes the irrelevance of species membership. So if pain is equal in the case of this beautiful dog and in the case of this pirate here, the human being, then it does not matter that whether it's his or her or whatever. Pain, but it's pain. Okay, if we combine this with the idea of moral rights, then I think we got a pretty simple but I think basically attractive idea of what at least a part of morality is all about, namely respecting individuals in the form of rights with regard to certain interests that are so important that from them some of our duties we have towards others follow. Okay. What is, I think, clearly incompatible with the idea that animals are beings with rights, with moral rights at least of their own, are three things that I want to mention shortly. Firstly, I think it is incompatible with this idea of animal rights that animals are be seen as mere resources for human purposes. Animals are not mere resources. Animals are beings who have valid claims against us. And this restricts, this seriously restricts what we are at liberty to do with regard to them. If it affects some of their most important interests, then we are in need of a justification which takes seriously their status as rights holders. So this is the first thing. Negatively speaking, when we accept that animals have rights, then we implicitly say that they are other than mere resources for our purposes. They have lives of their own. Second thing is, animals are also not mere pest. They are not mere dangers or something that has to be eliminated, as maybe this crocodile. Maybe you can see this crocodile in a certain context as a pest, as a danger. But again, the idea of animal rights would demand that you cannot reduce it, at least, to this contextual relevance it might have for us. But even such a creature has rights, irrespective of the fact that most people dislike crocodiles and fear them instead. So liking or disliking a being in and by itself is, again, morally not relevant. It cannot justify, I think, making morally relevant distinctions. And the third thing is, when we look at these two animals here as wild animals, that these wild animals are dependent upon natural habitats, and these habitats we have to see as populated by individuals who matter morally, so that their territories, their habitats, are no terra nullius. And so, by contrast, normally people think when unfolding the human life form, when entering into new, there are not so many now, but into new parts of a forest, into new deserts, into whatever, in order to extract the resources or to build houses or streets, they simply presuppose that there is nobody there who has valid claims against us. But if the argument for animal rights is basically correct, then there are always individuals that we have to take into account when taking the decision, for example, for discovering a new area as an area for resource extraction or the like. Now, I think among these problems, maybe the most problematic one concerns the fate of many of these types of animals. I have chosen a sheep, but I could also, and perhaps more obviously, have chosen a pig or a cow or a chicken. These animals are, trillions and trillions of them, subjected to industrial methods of farming. And these industrial methods of farming, I do not want to go into detail here, clearly reduce them to the status of mere resources for human purposes. So animal protection laws, which, to be honest, exist, and they might be a bit more stringent in Switzerland than in Germany, and in Germany a bit more stringent than in the US or whatever. But nevertheless, these animal protection laws function under the accepted presupposition that we are at liberty to make use of animals in various ways. And I would also add, this in the end always means that even trivial interests of humans outweigh fundamental interests of non-human animals. So, for example, if it's correct, as I guess it is, that we have no sheer nutritional need for meat eating or for drinking cow milk or eating eggs or whatever, if at least for most humans a vegan diet is perfectly accessible and healthy and tasteful and all these other things, then our preference, for example, for meat is a trivial one as compared to the things that the animals lose when we keep them in captivity in order to taste their meat, in order to gain their milk or whatever. So this, I think, is clearly a case in which we give trivial interests of ourselves more weight than fundamental interests, the interest in life and elementary well-being of other animals. And I think if there is something true in the idea that morality excludes arbitrariness, this is a clear case of an arbitrary distinction, which therefore means that we have to abandon this kind of system entirely. And not only reform it, I guess. But, okay, that is the first, and as already indicated, a rather general point which has been often been made by many authors who wrote about animal rights. And the first ones were the already mentioned Peter Singer from a utilitarian viewpoint and Tom Regan from a rights-oriented, more Kantian-inspired viewpoint, but there are many others now. And what I am now interested is something that now often is called a political turn in theorizing about animal rights or the moral status of animals. And now, I guess, we have again to ask not what with regard to these different animals might be morally relevant. And now we also, I think, have to take care of relevant differences. And the argument then will be that a particularly political theory of animal rights is committed to a relational approach which not only takes seriously the moral status of individual animals, but which also takes seriously the way in which humans relate to other animals. And this can make a difference. So, for example, if this crocodile is a wild animal and not living in captivity on a farm, if this chimp is not an inhabitant of a zoo, but again lives in his or her habitat, then they are in that regard maybe other kinds of being than these two, because sheep, domesticated sheep and dogs normally live together with humans. Dogs very often as pets or as privileged workers, as privileged animal workers such as guide dogs, police dogs or so, and sheep normally work for humans in an industrialized system of farming in order to gain their wool or whatever, also their meat. And of course humans are animals which are capable of entering into relations of a unique type, namely relations of political community, of citizenship, and the like. So, there are differences among animals. Some of these differences have to do with the capacities these animals have as individuals and via species membership. But some of the differences that we should morally take seriously have to do with relational facts concerning the way in which we as humans relate to other animals and implicate them into our form of life, so to speak. Very shortly, to the first kind of differences. One might argue, for example, that it is a morally relevant difference that normal crocodiles, except Nile crocodiles, but other crocodiles are solitary animals, whereas, for example, sheep are sociable animals. So cohabitation has another kind of significance in the case of sheep than in the case of crocodiles. It might matter morally, as many philosophers have argued, that the chimp is kind of a person in the technical sense in which philosophers often use the term person. Namely, there is some evidence, for example, from cognitive ethology, that chimps are self-conscious beings, that they know who they are in a way. Whether they also have a theory of mind or the like is much more contested, but nevertheless, there is some evidence that at least in a weak sense of the word, they are persons because they have the capacity to know who they are, to be self-conscious and not only sentient. Dogs have something special. They are genetically optimized with regard to contact with humans. So they are the descendants of wolves who have proven to be especially fit for human companionship. And now they have been bred selectively in order to optimize this feature so that humans, one might argue, are genetically designed, not by genetic engineering, but by selective breeding, to become our companions. And this might also matter because it might say something about the needs, the natural needs, that these beings have as a result of domestication process, and so on and so on. And humans, of course, are animals which have a lot of morally relevant features. For example, the capacity for autonomous and moral agency. So, for example, for beings like normally developed mature human beings, it matters whether we respect a right to religion, a right to freedom of speech, a right to suffrage, and many other kinds. Human beings have a sense of themselves as beings with a moral status, so they can care for their self-respect. Self-respect is something which does not directly matter for a crocodile, and I would guess not even for a chimp. So these are differences that are relevant. And remember, the argument that equal interests count equally, of course, does not exclude that unequal interests count unequally. So it is not speciesist. It is not illegitimately discriminatory to treat solitary animals other than sociable animals or animals which are cognitively more complex and and capable of complex problem solving, for example, different from animals that are more simple in that regard. Think about fish or amphibians or so. These are relevant differences, and they have to do with individual capacities, which normally lead back to species characteristics, because a species, of course, is relevant for what an individual animal can be and can do. But now think about the second type of differences I talked about, which I think lead to a more political reading of this entire idea of animal rights. And these are differences with regard to relational properties. And here is one relation that is morally relevant. So political philosophers, to say this first, often argue, although I will remain agnostic at this point, but many of them argue, following, for example, the famous work of John Rawls, that at least something like political duties of justice or duties of social justice have to be separated from moral duties more generally, and they are triggered only under the condition of certain particular kinds of associations, institutionalized relations, or relationships of other kind. So only if, for example, humans stand in relations of co-citizenship to each other, or in relations of enduring and institutionalized cooperation, or of being subjected to some kind of political, common political authority, only under the condition of these kinds, particular duties, namely duties of social or also distributive justice, are triggered. Whereas in the case of mere individuals have no special connection towards each other, we only have some so-called natural duties, such as the duty of no harm, or also the duty of rescuing someone in cases in which it is easy to do so. So we have, I think, strong duties of no harm, and also some strong duties of rescuing where it is easy to perform assistance. But apart from that, the argument goes, we have many, many kinds of duties which are only triggered by the fact that we stand in some kind of special relationship to others, be it citizenship or be it a common subjectedness to certain authority structure, or being part of a cooperative scheme which is institutionalized, and so on and so forth. So this is a view that is rather prominent in contemporary political philosophy. I think it's basically, we must not see it this way, but I will be agnostic at this point and then simply say that we can also, with regard to human-animal relations, make distinctions which are clearly, in a way, morally relevant, because we can stand to animals in rather different kinds of relationship which matter morally but matter differently. And this has nothing to do with the individual capacities of the animals. It has to do with the relational property as such. And I think one feature of what is now often called the political turn in animal rights is exactly this emphasis on the relevance of certain kinds of relationships. Now, using terms that are often, for example, used in theories of democratic legitimacy, one can, for example, distinguish cases in which we affect other animals in a profound way and thereby, for example, make them worse off. And we can distinguish from that, for example, constellations in which we subject animals onto social structures in which they are subordinate in order to serve as resources for human purposes. These are different kinds of affectedness by the human life form or by the activities of human agents. Again, take these two animals, the chimp and the crocodile, as examples for wild animals. Wild animals are often negatively affected by the way in which we unfold the human life form, for example, by resource extraction, or also as a side effect of civil wars or whatever is going on there. And in that way, they are clearly affected, and this kind of affectedness that we are responsible for many harms done to them, or other, in other words, that we are harming them. And so that many of these animals get killed or have to change their habitat due to human activities. This clearly makes a moral difference. So think about two animals. One is wounded due to an accident, a natural accident. And another one is wounded, but because a human hunter shot this animal. This clearly makes a difference for the kind of duties we have, beginning with the duty to stop hunting in most cases, but also I think with regard, for example, to duties of assistance, it makes a difference. So many would say we have no strong duties of assistance with regard to wild animals as such, but the picture might be rather different when we think about harm that is causally or normatively related to human activity and is something we account for. In the case of sheep and dogs, the most prominent kind of relationship has to do with subjecting animals under what, again, John Rawls has called the basic structure of society. These animals are part of our life form in a much more intimate way than normally crocodiles and sheep, if they are not, unfortunately, inhabitants and prisoners in zoos or in circuses or so. These animals normally are domesticated exactly in order to live with us and serve us. And this, I guess, is a relational fact which matters in and by itself. The general fact is that we have established normative orders, and these orders include many animals, for example, as beings that have to provide us with certain nutritional resources, milk, eggs, meat, and so on, or which have to serve as our models in scientific research or in applied science with regard to certain product testing, or. One might say, although this is quite euphemistically, that these animals, or many of these animals, stand in cooperative relationships with us. Or more exactly, that we have forced them into cooperative relationships. I say that's euphemistically because these cooperative relationships today, again, think about industrial farming, is really exploitative and nothing else. So if we think about cooperation as an endeavor for mutual benefit of all that participate in it, then it's clear that what we do with animals is radically asymmetrical to their detriment. We use them, but what they gain from this kind of cooperation is pretty poor in comparison. So, but nevertheless, one might say, even if we use a very broad notion of cooperative relationships, then we might argue that we have not only cooperative relations between humans and individuals and groups, but also between humans and animals. And in that regard, again, these animals are part of a life form for which we normatively account. and which we have imposed upon them in order for that they shall serve us in this or that regard. When looking particularly at domesticated animals, it is important to add that there is a kind of existential dependency on the side of these animals, because they are, down to their genetic makeup, designed to become dependent upon humans. So to take a simple example, this kind of sheep is domesticated in a way that it is in need of a shearing by humans. So it does not lose its wool naturally. It must have some humans who free it from the wool, who is growing and growing. And of course, as I already said, dogs, maybe they are in a way capable of becoming bewildered, but in some regards, they are genetically optimized in order to communicate with humans. And this kind of existential dependency, I think, is a clear case of subjectedness. And this raises the following question that I now want to raise. The question, namely, what to do with domesticated animals. And here, I guess, there's an alternative between a view which is, I would argue, in the end, an anti-political view, and it's some kind of abolitionism, which I would see as anti-political in that regard. And there are alternative views, and I will present one which I personally favor and find plausible, which is, so to speak, positively political. An anti-political view would be that the fact that there are animals that are existentially dependent upon humans is bad in itself and has to be abandoned as far as possible. So the most prominent figure in the field of legal and political philosophy who argues this way, or moral philosophy, is Gary Francione. And he is often identified with a rather strict version of what's called abolitionism. Abolitionism is, first and foremost, the idea that we have to abolish animals from a kind of status which is quite similar to slavery in the human case, or to a caste system as we have now in rural India today. So, and in that general sense, I think everyone who treats animal rights seriously is an abolitionist, because we want to overcome this system, these kinds of hierarchical and exploitative system as such, and not simply reform it, make some welfare reforms within such a frame, but we think the frame as such is fundamentally unjust. So that is not, I think, a point where there is a strong disagreement. But the disagreement arises when we look at a particular proposal of Francione, namely, that if you have domesticated animals, then you have animals who are genetically dependent upon some kind of human caring. They are designed in a way which makes them dependent upon humans, and that distinguishes them fundamentally from these kinds of creatures, the crocodile, the chimp, or so. And that is bad in itself. So the proposal goes, we should prevent these animals without, of course, using too cruel measures, but nevertheless, we should prevent them from further breeding so that they can die out. So in the ideal world, so to speak, there would be no longer any domesticated animal, and therefore also not this kind of institutionalized human-animal relationship that we now have with domesticated animals, because the fact of domestication is a fact of illegitimate domination, or results in a kind of illegitimate domination, and because we have to give up any kind of illegitimate domination, we have to end this kind of system. Why have I said that is essentially anti-political, because the political, in a way, is exactly about how to regulate ongoing relationships, how to cope with situations in which we depend upon each other and make this fact, in a way, productive so that each and everyone can gain benefit from it, which outweigh the burdens. I think there is a way to defend such a positive view of human-animal relations which is compatible with what I've said about the rights of non-human animals. And I will just sketch what I mean by that. The idea is that it is more attractive to see abolitionism not as a program that results in the extinction of domesticated animals, but a way as a way of transforming exploitative relations to the detriment of animals into relations that then are truly cooperative, because they are, in a way, relations between equals. Equals in the sense mentioned in the beginning, that in such instances in which other animals have relevantly similar interests than we have to take their interests seriously and therefore treat that these animals as our equals. But of course, only in those regards in which they are relevantly similar to us. So I would say, maybe this is a point for discussion in the end, that it is indeed a way of humanizing animals, to see them as potential co-citizens who can actively cooperate in developing laws which shall govern our life in such communities. I think, in a way, animals are not capable of active co-citizenship. This is, I think, what in the end is my criticism with regards to the book of Donaldson on Kümmlicka that you have mentioned in the introduction. But nevertheless, it makes sense to adopt some aspects of the citizenship idea and to see animals as co-members of our societies. And I will just give some hints of what this might mean. So for example, it means that if an animal is, due to domestication or selective breeding, dependent upon human companionship, then this animal must have some right to stay in a particular country and also a right to return to this particular country. And this is pretty similar or analogous to the right to stay and to return that we all have as citizens. So part of the status of citizen is exactly that we are not pushed into a no man's land of incompetence, but that we always rely on at least one state which is responsible for giving us shelter or allowing us to settle there, to come back. And I think exactly the same can be claimed with regards to those animals that we have bred and therefore made dependent upon us. But that's not the end of the story. The second and most important proposal would be that we should reframe the idea of a common good, which is, of course, essential to the validity claims we make in democratic decision-making and public deliberation. We at least pay lip service to the idea of a common good. And I think this commonality, which is addressed by this idea of common good, should be seen as a commonality which includes humans and other animals. So we are living in mixed human-animal societies, or in Rawls' terms, the basic structure of a society is a mixed structure. Animals are members. They are de facto members. They are subordinate members. They are members whose rights are regularly disregarded, but they are nevertheless members and they should be recognized as such. And that means that we do so as if these animals, for example, could participate in political voting. They cannot, because they cannot grasp the relevant concepts, such as voting itself, or authorization, or representation. They cannot grasp conceptually these kinds of institutional facts that are crucial for our idea of democratic citizenship and accountability. But we can, when asking about legitimate ways of governance, of legitimately structuring our social societal relations and institutional structure, we can take care of the co-presence of animals and take seriously that they are members whose interests matter equally. This would then mean that we need some kind of human advocacy, which, of course, should be institutionalized, but also performed, of course, as is even today, by social movements. But it must be also a kind of advocacy which makes sure that animal interests are fairly represented in public debates that aim at collectively binding decisions. One might also say, to use an idea popular from feminism, that we do not only need something like gender mainstreaming of laws, but we also need a kind of species mainstreaming. So decisions concerning power plants, concerning streets, concerning human settlements, concerning many other dimensions of life, of course also agriculture, of course also science, they should systematically be evaluated also with a view on the effects this has on animals who are, morally speaking, our equals insofar as they have relevantly similar interests. Who is responsible for this? To be sure, only a brief sketch. Ultimately, the state. Ultimately, in our idea of a division of moral labor, as one might call it, we say that the ultimate responsibility is on the side of states. But of course, this means in a democracy that we are all responsible, at least for reframing our societies in a way that would take seriously the idea of animals as equals. We are jointly responsible as citizens to put pressure on officials, on lawmakers, so that the laws no longer systematically disregard animals' interests but take them into account as they deserve. Again, this idea is not the entire story as, for example, Donaldson and Kimlicka tell them. So just to indicate again where the difference lies. Donaldson and Kimlicka argue that to treat animals really as members and not as something like a lower class or caste or even as slaves, this implies also to recognize their active agency and to see them as something like co-authors of the laws that govern our relationships with them. And they present many, many examples which clearly show that animals perform kinds of agency which causally influence in myriads of ways the way in which we see our public spaces, the way in which we think our societies are or should be. But this causal kind of influence, seeing dogs playing in the parks or cats or whatever, this causal kind of influence, I think, is nevertheless quite different from the kind of active co-citizenship that political theorists normally have in mind when they talk about this term. Normally we think that active co-citizenship means that we intentionally refer to a kind of imagined community, for example, a state, with regard to which we think about generally acceptable and just ways of lawmaking and of burden sharing. And this kind of shared intentionality with regard to an imagined community requires conceptual capacities that I would say indeed are uniquely human. So Yoda would have them, we normally developed humans have them. Animals, in the end, are dependent upon our willingness to include them into the political community for the very reason that they cannot claim this by themselves. They need, in this regard, human advocacy. And I wanted to present some arguments why they also deserve it. Thank you very much.